And welcome back to the Sports Ticket here on Katy Country 94, katycountry94.com, brought to you as always by Crossroads Bar and Grill in Downs, the best darn food in a railroad town. We're joined now by the play-by-play voice of Sporting KC, Nate Bucati. You could have heard him on the radio last year on the Jayhawk Radio Network with the Jayhawks as a sideline reporter for KU football. And Nate joins us to talk a lot of different things because Nate is multidimensional and very versatile. And Nate, let's begin with soccer, and glad to have you on. Thanks for the time, as always. How's things going for you in the job with Sporting KC?
Yeah, thanks for having me, Wade. Things are going good. It's a fun job. I'm really enjoying my time with Sporting Kansas City. My first year on the call of the Sporting games, and we've had our ups and downs as a team so far this year, but really enjoying it. It's a great organization to be a part of and having a lot of fun.
I've had a lot of people ask me recently. I've been the one Sporting KC game, and it was very entertaining, interesting. It ended in a tie. I don't like ties. Most people don't, but it was just a different atmosphere, kind of a different culture. I was trying to explain it to people. How would you explain it to somebody that hasn't been to a soccer game, how soccer, the sport of soccer, is a little bit different in regards to the atmosphere and the culture?
Well, the atmosphere at Sporting Park is as good as any stadium atmosphere, I would say, and maybe any sport in the country. It's absolutely first class. First of all, the stadium is probably the nicest soccer-specific stadium in all of North America. It holds about 19,000 in terms of seats. Now, they have some really nice standing room only areas, and so when they sell a lot of their standing room only tickets, they can get upwards of 21,000 fans in there. And the closest thing I can compare it to, me, is going to a Kansas basketball game, because what they call the South Stand, and then the section where the craziest fans are, the Cauldron, which is on the north side, they're behind both goals. Those fans stand and sing the entire game, kind of like when you go to a Kansas basketball game and the students are standing. They never sit down the entire game. Now, obviously, KU basketball games, they don't sing songs and bang drums the whole game, but that's kind of what the atmosphere is like. The fans that are on each sideline, you know, they're more like kind of like the KU alums that maybe just stand up and yell when they're mad at the refs or when a goal happens or something like that. But the sound from those fans in the South Stand and the Cauldron just echoes throughout the entire stadium, which they actually intentionally designed with a big overhang like a lot of the European soccer stadiums to bottle that noise in and make it rattle around in the stadium. So you feel like you're right there in the Cauldron with the rest of the people that are singing these songs while you're there. It's really something. And I would say when you ask us about the sport of soccer in general, I'll tell you, Wade, for me, I have a 5-year-old son and a 3-year-old daughter, and before I got this job, I was a season ticket holder at Sporting, and I would take my kids to the games ever since they were both born, basically. And I mean, at 2 years old, my kids love going to Sporting games, and they'll sit there through the whole game. And that's the only sporting event I could say that's the case for when they're at that age. And the reason is because, first of all, the games are only 2 hours long. Mm-hmm. 45 minutes in the first half, there's about a 15-minute break, and 45 minutes in the second half, and they never stop. There are no commercial breaks, so there's constant action. You know, in every other sport in America, you're looking at, you know, 3.5-minute timeouts here and there, and there's a lot of standing around and waiting for things to happen. And in soccer, there's constant action on the field the entire time, and there's no timeouts, and there's thousands of people singing songs and banging drums, which my kids are, kids love that stuff. So, I would say I've not talked to a person yet who's been to a game that didn't enjoy it, even if they don't like soccer. And I mean, 64 straight sellouts would back that up. That's what they're on right now. The fans in Kansas City have certainly grown to appreciate the atmosphere of this game.
I'll be the first to admit, I'm not a diehard soccer fan. I don't follow it as closely as the other sports, but if I grew up with it like your kids, it'd probably be a different situation. But at the same time, when I went, I was really excited about going. I took my oldest son, and we had a great time. And it is nice to be able to know that by 9 o'clock, if it's a 7 o'clock start, you're pretty much going to be done, and you'll be out of there. You can make plans after the game instead of, oh, the game went 12 innings or 18 pitching changes. Game went overtime. And it was fun. I enjoyed it, and I definitely want to go back. It's just a matter of getting tickets, which sometimes can be hard for Sporting KC because of what you just said.
Yeah, it's certainly a hot ticket. I think that the time of game thing, it's good for – it's a younger demographic. I mean, the season ticket – the average season ticket holder age at Sporting Kansas City is about 15 years younger than the average season ticket holder age at Royals Chiefs games. It's a younger crowd. And for a lot of the younger folks that want to go party, they like it because they can make plans for later. For me, as a guy with two kids, it makes it a lot more attractive because I know I'm able to get the kids home at a decent time. And, you know, and also, like I said, you know, the attention span of children is just not as long. Trying to get them to sit through a 3.5-hour NFL game or a 4-hour college football game or, you know, potentially 3.5-hour baseball game, I can't get my kids to sit through a baseball game yet. There's just so much standing around at this point. It just ends up frustrating me as much as anything because I want to watch the game. And they're, you know, they want to go play in the jungle gym out in, you know, Little K and all that stuff. But, yeah, soccer is good for that, you know. And college basketball is not the only other sport that's about that same time frame and only lasts 2 hours.
Yep.
I actually think of that as a big positive.
Yep, I agree with you totally. Nate Bucati, the play-by-play voice of Sporting KC, is with us. Now, Sporting KC has hit a bit of a skid here. They've lost 3 in a row, played a lot of matches in the month of August. Now they're going to have a 10-day layoff before their next game. They've slid to 4th in the conference in the standings. How do you assess things for Sporting KC at this point of the season?
Yeah, this is a bad stretch for them right now. And, you know, it's interesting because up until this three-game losing streak, they had only lost 4 games all year. They had never lost back-to-back games yet this season, and then all of a sudden they lost 3 in a row. And I think they're having a little bit of a difficult time processing that right now. For me, and it's going to sound like an excuse, I just look at this as the reality of the situation. The biggest problem for them is they've had a lot of injuries that, you know, they were able to make up for some of those injuries through the course of the year, but two players in particular, I just don't think they have a replacement for, and that's Roger Espinoza and Sony Mustafar. They're two of the three midfielders for Sporting Kansas City. And at one point before this three-game losing streak, people were talking about Sporting being the best team in MLS. They have a chance to win 3 separate competitions, which I know for fans that are not soccer fans, it might seem a little confusing, but they're in a competition called the U.S. Open Cup. They're going to be playing in the championship game of that. That's like a big national tournament. Maybe if you compare it to something like the Big 12 tournament or something like that. And they've made it all the way to the championship game of that. They have a chance to win the Supporters Shield, which is the trophy that goes to the team that ends up with the most points at the end of the regular season. And then, of course, if you're in the playoffs, you have a chance to win MLS Cup, which is the team that wins the postseason tournament. People were talking about them having a chance to win all 3 of those things. Well, the reason they were in the race for that, in my opinion, was because they had by far the best midfield in MLS. They had Benny Failhaber, who is, I think, in line to be possibly the MVP of the league this year. He's a great playmaker. He scores goals. He gets assists. They had Roger Espinoza, who just covers as much ground as anybody from the other team's goal to Sporting's goal. He's just all over the place, physical guy. He broke his foot. He's out for 10 weeks. And then they had a guy that plays a position called the holding midfielder position, which kind of stands right in front of that defensive back four and really is an important player and an underrated player on the team because he prevents a lot of the attacks from the other team before they even really ever get started. And the defense has really missed his cover ever since he got hurt. He's got a hip injury. And I just think Sporting hasn't been able to replace those guys. They might have to because they might be without him for an extended period of time here. So, yeah, they've got to regroup. Like you mentioned, that 10-day layoff. They got to get back to the drawing board before they go to Portland, which would be a very tough place to play a week from Wednesday.
Yeah, I would think the 10-day layoff comes at a nice time from the standpoint of you mentioned the injuries and playing a lot of games during the month of August, but at the same time, that's a long wait with having 3 consecutive losses just kind of sitting there in your mouth and souring in your mouth.
Yeah, you know, Peter Vermees, after their last game, these last 2 losses that they've had, they had second-half leads, and they blew them both and lost, ended up losing the game, which is very out of character for them. Usually, before that stretch, they hadn't lost the game all year when they scored first. But they were up 2-1 in Columbus, and they ended up losing that game, giving up 2 goals in the last 10 minutes. And then this past weekend, they were up 1-0, and then they gave up 2 goals in the second half to Colorado to lose 2-1. And after the game, the manager, Peter Vermees, basically just decided to take the time to light up the officials and blame the entire thing in both weeks on the refs, missing calls, which I think is pretty clear. They did miss a couple of calls in those 2 games that led to goals for the other team. But I'm kind of wondering if this is not more of a psychological ploy by Peter Vermees to try to show his players that he has their back. And his actual quote after the game was, "My players are not the ones losing these games. It's the guys in the yellow shirts," which referees wear yellow shirts most of the time in soccer. I don't know that he really believes that or if he's just trying to maybe take some of the pressure off of his players and show them that he's got their back right now because of what you said. They got 10 days. They got to try to you know, get some confidence back and get ready to go on another long, difficult road trip and try to win some games. Because in the past, Peter Vermees usually does not shy away from throwing his players under the bus when they play poorly, but he did not take that route this time. Maybe trying to, you know, again, show them a little support this time around and see if he can pick them up that way.
Next action coming up against Portland on September the 9th. Sporting KC with a record 11-7-7 and 40 points as it stands right now. Now, across town and in another state, technically, you would go to Kauffman Stadium where the Royals are having a banner year. You know, we had Ryan Lefevre on before the season, and something jumped out to me that what he said. And as soon as he said it, I was like, wow, this – You know Ryan very well. I've known Ryan over the years, and he's not one of these guys that's going to boast too boldly about anything. But he just said I asked, what do you think about this year's team? He says, I think this team's better, and I think this team will have the division wrapped up before they go on the road to end the season at Minnesota. He looks like a prophet right now. Did anybody else see this coming?
How long ago? When did he make these comments?
He made these comments during spring training, towards the end of spring training, getting ready before the first game of the season.
I sure didn't. And most people didn't. I mean, a lot of people were picking the Royals to finish as far down as third in the division this year. Look, the team last year won 89 games, which, you know, is not any great shakes. I mean, it's great for what we've seen in Kansas City for the past 30 years, but a lot of times that's not good enough to get you into the playoffs. And, you know, they got hot at the right time last year, and I think a lot of people looked at it as, okay, what did this team really do to get better? They lost James Shields. They replaced him with Edinson Volquez. They lost Billy Butler. They replaced him with Kendrys Morales. They lost Noy Aoki, and they replaced him with Alex Rios. I mean, on paper, that team's not any better. The team, and I even talked to some Royals execs before the season. I remember one of them, I had lunch with the Royals exec during the off season, and he asked me, "What's the perception in town of the team? What do they think of our off season?" And I said, "Well, to be honest with you, I think most people kind of feel like the team didn't really get any better on paper. So if the team's going to get any better this year, it's going to have to come from within. It's going to have to be guys like Mike Moustakas and Eric Hosmer and Lorenzo Cain really building off of the postseason that they had last year." And he basically, this was a Royals exec that said, "Yeah, I think that's about how we feel about it. You know, if we're going to get better, it's going to have to come from within."
Yeah.
And that's exactly what has happened, by the way. And maybe that's what Ryan was. You know, he was confident that those guys would do that. And they all have. You know, I mean, Lorenzo Cain, if it wasn't for Mike Trout starting to fall down to earth, and Josh Donaldson, I think Lorenzo Cain should be a candidate for MVP. And Eric Hosmer, actually, when you look at his offensive numbers these days, is right there with Lorenzo Cain. And we all know about the breakout that Mike Moustakas has had. He cooled off around the middle of the season, but now he's red hot again. These guys all did get better. They all did build off of what they did in the postseason last year. And, I mean, this team, I mean, here's the crazy thing about it, Wade. This team has the chance to have the greatest regular season in Royals franchise history.
Mm-hmm.
Now, you know, I know you're a little bit younger than me, but for somebody my age, you just don't say that any team could be better than that 1970 team. And I know the 80 team went to the World Series and the 85 team won the World Series, but every Royals fan I know that's been alive long enough to know anything about or even just paid attention to history to know about the 77 team, that team won 102 games. And when you look up and down that roster, it's loaded with all-stars, you know, everywhere you look. And some great pitchers that, had they been able to stay healthy, would be in the Hall of Fame today. You know, at the time that they were pitching in 1977, they were as good as anybody in the game. It seems like sacrilege to me to say that somebody could be better than them. And I don't know that this team's going to win 102 games. They got to basically win 2 out of 3 the rest of the way, which would be a little bit better than what they're doing right now. But, I mean, if you look at the way they've played over the last, you know, 28 games, I think they're 19-9. They're certainly, and that's the crazy thing about this team, they're playing. They still have their foot on the pedal, even though they hardly have anything to play for.
Yeah.
Maybe the fact that they're getting pushed a little bit by the Blue Jays right now for best record in the American League, but I don't even think they're motivated by that. I just think they're the kind of team that they just want to win every time they go out and play, and they stay motivated every day. There's only once Alex Gordon comes back and Ben Zobrist takes over second base, there's only going to be one weak spot in the entire lineup, and that's going to be in right field. They're fantastic defensively everywhere, even right field. And they've got the best bullpen possibly in the history of the game. And I say that without any sense of hyperbole whatsoever. And now the rotation's coming together as well. I mean, you know, Yordano Ventura's pitching well, mm-hmm. and now have that ace in Johnny Cueto, who's actually, ironically, not pitching as well. Edinson Volquez has been really good all year. Chris Medlin's coming into form now all of a sudden. And Danny Duffy's, you know, competing for one of those spots in the rotation in the postseason. I mean, this literally could be the greatest Royals team we've ever seen. And think about it this way, Wade. This team's already at 80 wins with 32 games to go. So they're going to win 90 games. Do you know the last time the Royals had a team just win 90 games, let alone 100?
Was that McCray in the no, that would have been 64-51. They had the strike, or they were on pace for that. So what it would have been?
It was 1989.
89.
I mean, and that team was considered a disappointment, you know, because they didn't make the playoffs because the A's were just a juggernaut. And this team is going to absolutely crush that number.
Oh, yeah.
But no, but think about that. I mean, we're not talking about some Herculean effort of winning 100 games. The Royals haven't had a team, even last year's team didn't win 90 games.
That's
the Royals
right.
have not had a team win 90 games since 1989. And they're going to do it this year, and they could be the best team that the Royals have ever had.
It's amazing. The one guy, well, first of all, Shields, Volquez, they put up the numbers the other day. Volquez is basically exact same numbers as Shields, except maybe a little better in a couple categories. I mean, Dayton Moore, what he's done, about everything he's touched has turned to gold. I mean, you had a guy that goes down the minors for 8 days, comes back, and then he comes up big in the playoffs, and he's an all-star this year, and he's been just red hot. Mike Moustakas, Hosmer. This is what Ryan Lefevre was saying. Ryan was saying before the season, and you're right. Big part of what he was predicting was that Hosmer, Kane, Moustakas, they're going to get better from their experience in the postseason last year. But he was one of those, and I think he was in the minority at the time, said, hey, Morales is going to have a full spring training. He's looking good. I think he's going to be very productive. He thought the Rios pickup was pretty good. Now I know he covers the team all the time, so he's probably looking at it a little bit with blue glasses. But I mean, Morales has been a huge success, and nobody dreamt that he could do what he does over Billy Butler. And then the other thing to me was, before the season, why I was like you, I was a little pessimistic, was Ventura and Duffy have to pitch 200 innings and be really good this year, and they haven't been, and they're still doing what they're doing.
Yeah, I mean, that's been the biggest surprise to me, is that for most of the season, this team's, you know, starting pitching staff ranked 23rd, I think it was, in all of baseball in staff ERA, starting staff ERA. And they were not logging a ton of innings. The bullpen was pitching a lot of innings. And I just didn't think, if you would ask me if that stat would be the case, would the Royals be running away with this division in early August? I mean, they technically had this division sewed up in August, at the start of August. I mean, if you'd asked me that, I wouldn't have believed it. And I would have thought that the bullpen would have broken down from overuse, because part of the reason the bullpen was so great last year was that they did get 1,000 innings out of their starting rotation, and they didn't have to overuse HDH. But what I didn't really appreciate, and I don't think anybody did, I don't remember anybody saying this, and maybe Ryan did, was the idea that this bullpen could be even better than it was last year.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I think everybody, you know, expected a little bit of regression out of the bullpen, just because bullpens from year to year can be pretty fickle. And a guy can be dominant one year and then kind of fall apart the next. And we've seen a little bit of that with Greg Holland this year. He has not been the same guy that he was the last couple of years. But they get Luke Hochhaver back, and I know he gave up the home run yesterday, but he's been a weapon. You know, they get Morales has been a good find for the team. You know, for a while they had Medlin in the bullpen pitching well for them. Madsen's been, you know, fantastic for the most part in the bullpen. Their bullpen was so good that they had a guy who had a 1.45 ERA, and they just cut him.
That's right.
They just designated him for assignment. They didn't even need him.
Yeah.
And I know that Jason Frazier's peripheral numbers weren't great, but how many teams in baseball cut a guy mm-hmm. with a 1.5 ERA in their bullpen? It just doesn't happen. But that's every guy in their bullpen's been amazing this year. So it hasn't just been HDH. It's been, you know, all 6-7 guys. And, you know, with Luke Hochhaver working his way back into form and all that, it even gets better. So, you know, that's one of the things that has happened this year that really I didn't expect.
And Dayton was the only GM to offer a major league contract to Chris Young, and he was a godsend right. early in the year, and now he could play a big role in the bullpen and long relief and so forth and so on. I want to go back to one thing you said, because you said it so confidently it stood out to me. And that was, when Zobrist takes over at second, the Royals will only have one weak link in their offense. You seem really certain about that. Now, see, I would say that I could see that scenario, but I also see the scenario where he plays right because of the DP combination of Escobar and Infante doing such a nice job there. Although Rios has come on as of late, so has Infante. Why do you seem so confident that's going to be the move they make?
Well, Ned Yost basically said so. I can't remember if it was yesterday or the day before down in Tampa that that it's going to be Zobrist going to second base on an almost daily basis once Gordon comes back.
Okay, so I missed that.
Why I say that with confidence. But and I think it's the right move. Personally, I'd like to see Paulo Orlando and Gerard Dyson get more playing time, in right field and maybe even in a platoon situation. Both of them have higher OPSs than Alex Rios does right now. But, you know, Ned Yost isn't usually one to mess with things when they're working. So, yeah, you're right, though. Infante's played good defense this year. That's been the one thing he's been able to help the team with. But, look, his offensive numbers are so bad that it's hard for me to say you can even justify keeping that bat in the lineup. You know, you're talking about a guy with an on-base percentage of something like 260 on the year and with no power on top of that. It's just too bad to put up with. And it'd be one thing if Ben Zobrist was like a butcher defensively, but he'll be fine defensively at second base. And what he brings offensively is just leaps and bounds better than what you're going to get from Omar Infante right now.
Postseason roster, to me, it would make sense. It's logic that Guthrie's not on it. You only need 12 pitchers, not 13, when you have a day off here and there in the playoffs. To me, Orlando should be on there instead of Guthrie because, one, he can steal a base for you. He can play good defense. He's got range, and he can hit the ball out of the park. Would you agree with that?
Yeah, well, and I also think you got to remember Terrence Gore. You know, he was a guy that made the postseason roster last year. I believe he still does not have a single hit in his major league career, Terrence Gore, but he's got about 8 stolen bases. But he's the kind of weapon I think that they'll want to have on their postseason roster again, because if they're in a one-run game, you bring in an absolute stolen base weapon and Terrence Gore. So you got to factor in where he'll fit on the roster as well. But I agree with you. I don't think there's any spot on this roster for Jeremy Guthrie. And I think he knows it, to be honest with you, after hearing his comments when he lost the spot in the starting rotation.
Is there no spot for Christian Colon with Zobrist then, probably?
That's a good question. I guess it depends on how the roster ends up shaking out. If you have Omar Infante on the roster and Ben Zobrist, probably not.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't think they're going to walk from Omar Infante at this point. But, you know, he's only able to play one position, and that's something that Christian Colon does give you, is some versatility.
Do you think the Royals can, is there being talk about Zobrist re-signing him for next year?
You know, every time the Royals get asked about that, they say, look, we're just focused on this year right now. And that's the right answer. I mean, the reason they made the trade was to make themselves a better team in the postseason. I mean, both the trades that they made, and that's just show you how different life is in the world of the Kansas City Royals now than at any point in my lifetime since 1985, is that they made trades that had nothing to do with the regular season. And these, you know, this Cueto and Zobrist trade were not about winning games in the regular season. They were about winning games when they got to the postseason. And, that's what this is all about. Now, if you're asking me if I think there's a chance they could sign him, yeah, absolutely, I do. He's a guy that fits perfectly with his team. I think he and his wife like the community quite a bit. I don't think he's a guy that's going to command a huge price tag on some really long-term deal somewhere else because of his age. He's in his mid-30s. And the Royals, and I think rightfully so, shy away from extremely long-term contracts that are going to commit them to a bunch of money. And as a small market team, you just can't afford to do that. Because those contracts always, in the end up being a whole bunch of dead money at the end. And some teams can afford to absorb that. I don't think the Royals are one of those. So, Zobrist, though, might be a guy you can get on a 2-year deal, maybe a 3-year deal. It might be something that they're comfortable with. But, he's going to be very old by the end of that contract if it's a 3-year deal. So that's something that you have to keep in mind.
Alex Gordon, odds that the Royals re-sign him, he stays in Kansas City. He's obviously going to get a big payday.
Before his injury, I would have put the odds at 5%. I just didn't think there was much of a chance at all. I mean, I think he's going to walk away from the option that he has at the end of this contract. And this is his one chance to get paid. He's in his 30s now as well. So this is his one opportunity to get a long-term contract and maximize what he's worth. And look, it's just a reality of things. I mean, people can be upset about it and you know, frustrated or whatever, but I think that Alex Gordon is the kind of player that some other team will be willing to give a long-term contract to for a whole lot of money.
Yep.
And I don't think it would be smart for the Royals to do that. It's not stupid for a team that has a $200 million a year television contract, you know, to give that kind of money to a guy like Alex Gordon. And they're doing so basically knowing that the last two or three years of that deal, they might not get much out of him at all. It's not smart for the Royals to do something like that. So from an economic standpoint, I just don't think there's much of a chance. Now, maybe his injury will drive down his price a little bit or, you know, I don't know, possibly cause him to look at things differently. And it's also possible that Alex Gordon just wants to play his whole life as a Kansas City Royal. I mean, that's the one chance you got.
Mm-hmm.
Is you can tell him, look, man, you can spend your entire career as a Royal. That'll make you one of the franchise all-time greats because nobody does that anymore. You could be on the Rushmore of Kansas City Royals all time, especially if you go to several postseasons and maybe win a World Series. But, you know, that to me, there's no economic way to sell Alex Gordon on staying in Kansas City or to sell the Royals on keeping him in Kansas City. So it's going to have to be all on the emotional side of things if they want to try to keep him.
Do you see a scenario where the Royals don't want to give a long-term deal to Alex Gordon, so their fallback plan has been Zobrist? You sign him to whatever the deal it is. I know Zobrist, I think, is 34, older than Alex. Then you have Zobrist in left or right. You're contracted to Infante, invested in him, so he comes back as your second baseman. Can you see that scenario where Zobrist? Well, and even there's a scenario where Zobrist could play right. Rios is on a one-year deal, Infante at second, and Gordon at left. Do you see either of those scenarios playing out?
Definitely possible. I mean, that's one of the things that makes Ben Zobrist so attractive,
yeah,
is that he can play so many different places for you. So I absolutely think the Royals will try to re-sign him and plug him in wherever they have a spot they need to fill. Speaking of dead money, I mean, the Royals did give a guaranteed contract to Omar Infante, and
yep,
they're going to be, you know, wasting a lot of money because of it over the next couple of years, because it doesn't look like, you know, he's got anything left in the tank at this point in his career. But you know, look, and also, you know, Zobrist is a guy that maybe can hold the fourth down. And if Bubba Starling, now he looks like he's starting to show some things and come on, maybe he can take one of those outfield spots down the road. I do think that, you know, those corner outfield spots are spots you can find a guy to play for a year or two for you. They're not as hard to find as, you know, a shortstop, a catcher, a really good center fielder. And so that's another reason. Look, I think the Royals would love to keep Alex Gordon. That's another reason that you don't hamstring your entire franchise to re-sign a corner outfielder, because you can actually find those guys even in a smaller market.
Nate Bicchetti, the voice of Sporting KC, and used to be the sideline reporter at KU, and of course they have their own show on 810 WHB, the Border Patrol, covering Royals, Chiefs, and everything in Kansas City. Let's turn our attention to KU, where you were the sideline reporter the last few years, and now you're stepping away from that to focus on your duties of Sporting KC. David Beatty's a new head coach. I heard that the Vegas over-under for wins for KU is 1.5. I've been telling some K-State friends of mine, you got to put some money on that if you're in Vegas, right? 1.5 wins. You've seen the schedule. Cozart is the quarterback. David Beatty's the new coach. What are your expectations? I mean, they're obviously probably not that high for any KU fan going into the season.
Yeah, I mean, look, let me start by saying that I'm a huge fan of David Beatty. First of all, I just genuinely really like the guy. He's a very likable guy. He's the kind of guy that you want to root for. And I think he's the kind of guy that KU fans, you know, should want to see succeed and should feel proud of as being their head coach. And he's going to try to do all the right things. He's going to work his butt off. He's going to be positive. He's going to make his coaches work their butts off and recruit everywhere, especially in the state of Kansas, in ways that maybe they haven't in the past several years, build things up the right way. But he has got a Herculean task in front of him. I mean, I'm not going to sit here and sugarcoat it for you. For me, 1.5 wins seems pretty generous for this team. And through no fault of David Beatty's whatsoever. But you got to remember the roster disaster that he inherits from Charlie Weiss. When this team takes the field on Saturday against South Dakota State, an FCS school that is limited to, 65 scholarships?
Mm-hmm.
David Beatty's team will have fewer scholarship players than South Dakota State will.
Wow.
Now, I don't know that all those are full scholarships for South Dakota State and all that, but just let that sink in for a minute. We've got a lot of 20 more scholarships at the FBS level than you are at the FCS level, and you're going to have fewer. it's just an absolute nightmare what David Beatty walked into. And that was before his starting quarterback had his knee blown out by a walk-on in the spring game. That was before he had to kick off his top-returning running back for disciplinary reasons. You know, that was before a couple of other guys defected from the offensive and defensive line. It's just, look, a culture change has to take place, an entire roster. I mean, it's going to take them several years because you're only allowed 25 scholarships per year to even get back to their full scholarship capacity at KU, let alone getting good scholarship players. You know, so, I take no joy in laying it out there for you. I just think that people should be aware of what David Beatty has to take on here. And, you know, look, the last two coaches at KU only lasted a couple of years apiece. And I'm not suggesting that the wrong move was made either time by firing either of those coaches, because there was nothing being shown in terms of progress. And, in fact, there was all kinds of signs being, you know, that things were being run in the wrong direction. But you're going to have to give David Beatty more than 2 years to have any idea what he's capable of or what direction the program is headed in. I mean, I think you're just going to have to grin and bear it the next couple of years, which stinks for KU fans because they've had to grin and bear it for several years now since the Mark Mangino era. But I'm just afraid that's going to be the case because there are no quick fixes. The reason that they're in the roster problem that they are right now is because Charlie Weiss tried to do the quick fix, and all that ends up doing is putting you in a worse position down the road, and that's where KU is right now.
And he hands it off to a new head coach coming in, David Beatty. South Dakota State comes Lawrence Summit, coming up on Saturday to open up the season at 11 a.m. Okay, KU basketball, something a little bit more fun to talk about for KU fans. Real quickly, the experience with the World Games, winning the gold had to be something for them. This Kansas basketball team coming up has to be the favorites again. I say you pick them to win the Big 12 until they finally lose the Big 12 title. You're crazy to pick against them. There's some new coaches in the league. Obviously, Shaka Smart at Texas stands out. Oklahoma's got the player of the year coming back. Iowa State has a new coach, but a lot of talent. How do you see KU basketball shaping up this year?
Now, I'll tell you what, that Iowa State roster is going to be really good, yeah. Too. I think they're going to be a team that really challenges KU. But, you know, Oklahoma, you mentioned as well. As for KU, I think everybody that watched those World University games is very encouraged by what they saw. And I talked to actually Coach Self on my morning show in Kansas City live from Korea during the course of that tournament. It was a great conversation. It always is with Coach Self because he's just a great interview. But I asked him at that time, give us a frame of reference. How good is the competition out there for these World University games? I mean, how would they stack? How would these teams stack up against the Big 12? And he said, you know, one of the teams that they played against, he thought was good enough to compete with any team in the Big 12. And another one of the teams they faced, I think it was Serbia, I can't remember now, but he said that they would flat out win the Big 12. And I thought that was a pretty good, okay, that's a good frame of reference. Then Kansas went out and beat all those teams and won the gold medal. And I think the most encouraging signs from that was, number one, the play of Wayne Selden. I thought, you know, he showed some things that KU fans have been wanting to see from him in the first 2 years of his career, that if he can build off of that performance in Korea, he can finally become that type of difference maker that they've really wanted him to be. He just was more aggressive. He looked more athletic. He just looked more dangerous on the offensive end. And Hunter Mickelson, I thought, was a real revelation, too. And that's one of the things Bill Self told me when I talked to him. He said he's been most impressed with Hunter Mickelson. They need some low post presence this year, especially on the defensive end. And he sure looked like he might be a candidate to step up and be that guy for this team. They've got a lot of players back. They're going to have a lot of veteran players on the team, you know, led by Perry Ellis. And I think that the freshman class, it'll be interesting to see what happens with Cheick Diallo and his eligibility and all of that. But I think this is a team that's going to have all the pieces to win the league again this year and be a dangerous team in March.
All right, Nate, final question, time for off-the-wall question. We asked Greg Sharp this question this week, the voice of the Huskers. And I'm going to ask you because you, of course, with Sporting KC, you probably come across some interesting names. What's the hardest name you've ever had to pronounce on the radio?
Oh, boy, that's a good one. There is, now that I'm doing MLS, you have just a litany of foreign players, right?
Yeah.
That you have to work on. And the challenge that I have, now that you've asked that, the challenge that I have with this is look, every different language has a different pronunciation and a different way that they pronounce letters. And some of them are pronunciations and, you know, sounds that we don't even make in the English language. So how far do you go to try to pronounce someone's name correctly when you call these games in English is my question. Because even if you just go with Spanish, you know, there's a famous player named David Villa. That's what everyone calls him in English. But, you know, in Spanish, it's actually David, right? But am I supposed to say David every time he runs down the field? It's spelled David. Nobody calls him David Villa. They all call him David Villa. So it's like it's somewhere in between the real pronunciation and the not. And you know, the English pronunciation. There's a guy that plays for Colorado in the game we just did last week who's from Sweden, and his name is Axel Sjöberg, is what everybody calls him in America. It's spelled S-J-O-B-E-R-G. But they have a deal where you can click on each player's name on the team websites in MLS, and the player will say his own name so you can hear it. And he says his own name, and he says, Axel Sjöberg. That's as close as I can come to actually pronouncing it the way that he said it. Hoiberry. It's spelled Sjöberg, but he said Hoiberry.
Oh, wow.
So I don't know about that one. And the other one I'll give you is there's a guy who plays for the Chicago Fire named Kennedy Egbonanike.
Wow, good. I like it. You said it like you knew what you were saying there. That was good.
I've heard him say it on the website. It's a very handy tool, but yeah, so I'll go with Kennedy Egbonanike because of, I think it's five syllables if you say it all correctly. So that's probably the toughest one I've had this year.
Wow, that does sound tough. Tell everybody where they can listen to the games on the radio. You're on 810 WHB, right?
Yeah, Sports Radio 810 WHB on the radio. If you know, and I'm not sure what all the television affiliate situations are like in your neck of the woods, Wade. But if you go to sportingkc.com. You can probably find out where the games are televised on SKC TV. I know we're across the state of Kansas. We're in Nebraska. We're in Oklahoma. We're in Missouri. So you should be able to get them on television in HD right there in your hometown.
Outstanding. Nate Bucated, the voice of Sporting KC, joining us today on the Sports Ticket. Nate, as always, we enjoy the conversation. Thanks for the time, and we look forward to listening to you cover Sporting KC for years to come, man.
Hey, thanks a lot, Wade. Appreciate it.